Why are you religious? It might surprise you to learn that I do enjoy comedians when they do their little routines. And one of them, Emo Phillips, he's a very odd guy, but anyway, a very funny comedian, is quoted as saying things like this: I was my neighbor's imaginary friend. Or this one, this is risky maybe. I found my wife in bed with another man. I was crushed, so I said, "Will you two get off of me?" Well, Phillips wrote a joke that has been told and retold many times, and in September of the 2005 Guardian website, which conducted a poll worldwide, decided that it was the very best joke ever told. I share it with you because it leads right into our topic for today, but also because I think it's incredibly funny. Once, this is Emo talking, once I saw this guy on a bridge ready to jump. I said, "Don't do it." He said, "Nobody loves me." I said, "God loves you. Do you believe in God?" He said, "Yes, I am." Then I said, "Are you a Christian or a Jew?" And he said, "Well, I'm a Christian." I said, "Me too. Protestant or Catholic?" He said, "Protestant." I said, "Me too. What franchise?" He said, "Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist?" He said, "Northern Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist?" He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist Eastern region?" He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Regional Council of 1912. I said, "Die, heretic," and I pushed him off the bridge. Is there any difference between your religion and your faith? I know that they're intimately connected. I get that. But are there any ways that we can actually see them as separate entities? I think they're separate, actually. And the best way I've ever come to terms to describe the difference is that faith is what we ultimately believe, and religion is how we practice that faith, or the practical application of that faith. And I think we all instinctively know the difference. We do. For several people, I think there's a real inner conflict between their religion and their faith. At some time in all of our lives, there arises a crisis or experience that challenges our beliefs or our faith. But we will continue to carry on our religion in the desperate hope that somehow those two things will once again reconnect. Perhaps that's why some folk are so insistent on certain religious practices being done a certain way, because if its facade was ever taken away, the internal doubts would crush them. Even joke about the disconnect between faith and religion. I get into trouble quite often at home when Laura asks me to do something I don't particularly want to do. And my lame excuse and humor is to express my displeasure at the task by saying, "What? I can't. It's against my religion. I don't know how cleaning bathrooms is against any religion, but I still try to claim it." It doesn't work, by the way. Even the secular world knows the difference between faith and religion. Recently, you may have heard, this has been going on now for a few years, there's a new law in the province of Quebec that bans religious face coverings from provincial employees. and also from receiving provincial services. In other words, if a woman goes into a license bureau wearing her niqab because of her religion, she now has to reveal her face if she wishes to get a health card or a driver's license. That's the law in Quebec. And recent polling nationwide reveals that a clear majority of Canadians agree with Quebec's stand on this. It's okay, we tell ourselves, to believe what you like as far as your faith is concerned if your religion is not right in front of me, is not overtly in front of me. In today's gospel lesson, Jesus is addressing two major issues when it comes to faith and religion. Now, I should also be very careful in mentioning to you that Matthew is very intentional in setting the scene of his biblical records. It's one of the things Matthew loved to do. In particular, he seeks to be accurate in this passage about who he's speaking to and where. Matthew 23 begins with Jesus addressing not religious leaders, not at all. He's talking to the crowd that is following him and his own disciples. Now, there would have been scribes and Pharisees in that crowd following Jesus, but he seems to ignore them until verse 13, the next passage. And instead, he speaks to those the leaders are supposed to lead. And the first thing Jesus says, it might surprise you. He states that the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. Well, maybe I haven't fully explained yet a bit more about these Pharisee folks. The Pharisees were always men. And most often they came from wealthier families. They were not priests. This is very important. Nor could they ever be one. Priests had to be from the tribe of Levi or to be Levites. That was God's decision way back in Moses' day. So being that they were excluded from priestly service, these men gathered together and took a lot of time and effort to study the law. And this was something not only expected of every Jewish man, but it was encouraged. For a lack of a better description, these Pharisees were a sect of Judaism committed to the law and the application of the law. That's their whole reason for existence. Today in the church, we might describe them quite loosely as laymen. But they took their task very seriously. Now, the people in Jesus' day, we see that really well played out in the Chosen series. The people in Jesus' day revered them and depended on them to help them avoid transgressing the law. And so people would come to these Pharisees and consult them on decisions in matters of the law and to learn, well, what should I do? So when Jesus says they sit on Moses' seat, he's acknowledging that these Pharisees are an authority on all matters of the law. High praise, isn't it? He's not dismissing them as irrelevant. Quite the contrary, actually. Jesus encourages the crowd and the disciples to listen to these men when they talk about the law and to follow what they say. However, Jesus also says that you should follow what they say, but don't do what they do. Oh. In other words, he's saying to the crowd that they're hypocrites. That the Pharisees were very adept at teaching the truth about the law, but often they failed to follow it themselves. Do you remember Paul the Apostle? I'm sure you do. You know, he was a Pharisee. In fact, he was an extremely devout one. Before his conversion to Jesus, he carried a great deal of clout among the Pharisees and also in the Jewish court in Jerusalem called the Sanhedrin. He was a powerful guy. As he says of himself, I was zealous for the faith of my fathers. So we wonder what he might say to his fellow Pharisees after his conversion. Well, guess what? You don't have to wonder anymore. He gives it to us in Romans 2:17. And this is what he writes. But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast of your relationship to God and know his will and determine what is best because you're instructed in the law, and if you are sure that you are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then that teach others, will you not teach yourselves? Yet there's more than hypocrisy at work here. Jesus also mentions this passage, doesn't he? The heavy burdens that Pharisees placed on people, which they themselves avoided. We might forget that beyond the law, there was this great application of the law, the Talmud. And the Pharisees had spent enormous amounts of time figuring out all the minutiae of ways to avoid breaking the law by having more law. And then they would create these elaborate, creative interpretations. I've shared some of these with you over the years. They claimed that by following these interpretations, people wouldn't violate the law and therefore wouldn't be in God's bad books. However, these additional rules created tremendous hardship for people, particularly the poor. Let's say in struggling to meet ends or make ends meet, many of the poor would violate, maybe not the law, but they might violate certain interpretations of the law. For example, the law forbade the consumption of certain foods, but if you're desperately hungry and you could easily secure non-kosher food, well, you gotta eat. Desperate people often feel compelled to do whatever they can to survive, even in violation of the law. That still goes on today. But the Pharisees could have been more law-abiding if they had lessened the burden on their people. Maybe instead of condoning someone for eating non-kosher food, they could have given them some kosher food or money to buy proper food. Instead of condemning the tax collector and the prostitute and the leper, how about finding ways to help them get out of their predicament or be cared for in a loving way? At least we think the church is exempt from such critiques. We're not. Our religion has a past, doesn't it? Maybe it's still going on, causing untold burdens upon people. How many people over the years have avoided a fellowship with God's people because they felt they couldn't measure up? Maybe they felt they weren't knowledgeable enough of the faith to come in and worship God. Maybe they thought they couldn't give enough money to the church to gain respect, to gain a welcome among God's people. Maybe we still put a lot of burdens on people. Perhaps not overtly, but maybe our quiet acceptance of certain standards we think people need to meet just burdens people. A member of an upper-class downtown church tells the following true story. It was a very cold winter's night one Sunday, or cold winter's day, excuse me, that one Sunday, and the parking lot at this prestigious church was full. And the man telling the story says, I noticed that as I got out of my car with fellow church members, they were gathered in front of the church whispering among themselves as they walked to the church. As I got closer, I noticed that there was a man leaned up against the wall outside the church. He was almost lying down as if he was kind of asleep. He had a long trench coat on that was almost in shreds. His hat topped his head, and it was pulled down over his face so you couldn't see his face. He wore shoes that looked 30 years old and too small for his feet. Shoes had holes all over them, and his toes actually stuck out in the cold. I assumed, like everyone else, that this man was homeless and he was sleeping there. So I walked by him through the doors of the church and went in. We all enjoyed fellowship for a few minutes, and then someone brought up the man who was laying outside the door. And people snickered and gossiped. No one bothered to ask him to come in to get warm, including me. A few minutes later, church began. We all waited for the preacher to take his place and give us the word when the doors to the church opened wide. And in came that homeless man. He walked down the aisle with his head down, and people gasped and they whispered and they made faces. The man made his way down the aisle, walked right up onto the platform to the pulpit, and then he took off his hat and his coat. And my heart sank. And there stood our preacher. He was the homeless man. No one had said a word. The room was, it was silent still. Preacher took out his Bible and he laid it on the pulpit. Folks, I don't think I have to tell you what I'm preaching about today. Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did it to me." And proceeded to preach a sermon about treating others with dignity and kindness, even if they seem to be the least. The second concern that Jesus raises in this passage is described by him as they desire to do all their deeds to be seen by others. They make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long on their prayer shawls. They love the places of honor at banquets and the best seats in the synagogue and to be greeted and respected in the marketplace and have people call them rabbi. I guess the first thing I should do is explain to you what a phylactery is. Maybe I've already shared this. Simply put, a phylactery is a small leather box that Orthodox Jewish men still to this day would place on their foreheads. And inside that little leather box would be written out words of the law. And the idea was that when a Jewish man went to pray, he would always have that physical reminder of the law. Jesus is suggesting that the Pharisees in question made huge, big ones to show off in public. It was a way of trying to appear more devout. They also, on their prayer shawls, would wear fringes that were extremely long, again, to show how devout they were. The other things they do help us understand what Jesus is getting at even better. The Pharisees loved attention. They used their religion to gain prestige and influence. And just a further verses down, we hear that they also got financial gains by being Pharisees. And Jesus makes this odd comment about how Pharisees would devour widows' houses. It seems odd, doesn't it? What happened here was that if the Pharisee would go to a rich widow and ask that rich widow to sponsor them as they studied the law, and therefore that rich widow might take them on looking after them, and they would devour their home. In general, Jesus is talking about using your religion for personal gain, whether it is monetary gain or popularity. And quite often, those two things go hand in hand, don't they? At the heart of this problem is our egos. Let's be honest. We trick ourselves and get tempted into believing our own press. We erroneously believe that the world, or more accurately, the faith community revolves around us. For ministers, it's particularly an awful temptation. It can lead sometimes to the most ridiculous scenarios you can ever imagine. I remember talking with Michael Strain, who was the pastor at Villanova Church many years ago when I was a pastor at Tyrrell over here. They had a guest preacher come for their church anniversary. And Michael did the right thing. He greeted him when the man arrived, and he proceeded to sort of give him a tour of the facility, acquaint him with the sanctuary and the pulpit, which you do with a guest speaker. Immediately, this guest replied that he'd brought his own pulpit with him to preach from. And it was imperative that it be installed on the platform for him. Michael's congregation were not very pleased. Ministers are particularly prone to this problem, but you know, lay people can succumb to it too. It's tempting to want to be noticed. We love to be acknowledged. We like it when people talk about how wonderful we are. I heard about a man who was being honored by a church family with a banquet. And he was expected to give a speech at the end of the meal. And the man who was introducing the honoree went on and on with one praise after another about the speaker's qualifications and achievements. The honoree obviously was extremely embarrassed by the flowery introduction, so he began his remarks with these words. You know, I came here in hopes of hearing a fascinating speech. I was hoping to hear my lips drip brilliant phrases and memorable stories. Now I must tell you that after that glowing introduction, I'm afraid I'm going to be disappointed. I know, as well as you know, stories of church folk who get downright angry because their efforts, their contributions are not acknowledged. One of the things that Jesus says in this passage that I find particularly convicting is his critique of the Pharisees for demanding that they be called rabbi. Then Jesus talks about how that's very presumptuous. Henry Nouwen, in his book, In the Name of the Father, writes about how imperative it is to be willing as a person to be led rather than to lead all the time. To being open to being taught as opposed to being compelled to teach on every occasion. In God's kingdom, Jesus is saying, we're all students. We all have things to learn. We all have ways we can continue to grow and mature. There's no place in the kingdom for anyone who doesn't feel that they cannot be stretched intellectually and spiritually. This rigidity of thinking we often describe as being narrow-minded, right? This passage is really about the nature of a healthy leadership. More specifically, leadership in the kingdom of God. Jesus specifically calls it here and elsewhere a servant leadership. You've heard that before. Jesus told us that he came not to be served, but to serve. And he wants that same attitude for his followers. And thus we come head on into the hardest lesson from this passage. Humility. Humility. That elusive character trait, right? For the moment you think you've achieved humility is the moment you've lost it. Or as I used to joke to people, please be ready to receive my new book entitled Humility and How I Achieved It. I heard about a story about a woman who was on her deathbed and she was dying and her family had gathered around her bed to comfort her and be with her. And as she was fading, the family began to talk about what a wonderful mother and grandmother she had been. They talked about her great cooking, her hard work, her volunteer service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And after a few moments of this, the woman spoke up from the bed with a very weak and raspy voice. Don't forget to remember how humble I am. I think Jesus helps us with humility. With reminding us that we need to keep first and foremost in our minds and in our hearts our actual place in this universe. God isn't looking for religious people, friends. God's looking for faithful people. God is looking for people whose hearts are aligned with his. and whose hearts can be nurtured and led and crafted into humble people committed to serving in his name. Are you? Am I? One of those persons? I truly hope so.